This WBEZ podcast is supported by Wise, the app for international people using money around the globe. With the Wise account, you can send, spend, and receive in up to 40 currencies with only a few simple taps. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. Terms and conditions apply. Be smart. Get Wise. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration prepares professionals to address today's most pressing challenges and offers flexible options with part-time and evening classes to support busy adults balancing complex schedules. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work.
Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Make sure you stick around for a breakdown of the day's top stories in the Chicago area at the end of this episode. But first, in 2019, a wrongful police raid turned Anjanette Young's life upside down and left her demanding accountability from the city. Now she could soon have a direct hand in shaping that accountability. Young has been tapped for a seat on Chicago's Police Oversight Commission, a group with real power to influence policy inside CPD. In this episode of the pod, my conversation with Anjanette Young. She talks about the changes she'd like to see happen next and the road ahead to getting there. And she details the scary encounter 7 years ago in a new memoir called Past the Pain, How to Emerge from Trauma with Purpose. As a social worker and advocate, Young shares practical advice in the book, including words of wisdom from her own therapist about how people, particularly those facing injustice, can move forward in their own stories. So at the table with me was Anjanette Young. Now, as I mentioned, it's been 7 years since that humiliating raid at her home, and so much outreach and advocacy work since then. So I started with a very simple question. How are you doing today? Here's Anjanette.
Today I'm good. I mean, literally today. But overall, it's been a journey, and I like to call it my healing journey, which is what I really talk about in this book, what it took for me to live that moment. And how did that move forward from that moment? And in my book, Past the Pain, How to Emerge from Trauma with Purpose, I talk about like that journey of healing and how advocacy played a role in that and how I want to share with others that they can also too move past a traumatic event in their lives.
Absolutely. And we'll dig more into it because I understand you worked with your, you're sharing some of the advice that you got from your therapist, which is some really good stuff. So we'll dig into that. But I wonder, you know, of course, the impetus for the book is, of course, what happened to you 7 years ago. And when you think about that raid these days that so many of us got to see on video, Anjanette, what still crosses your mind right now about that moment?
What crosses my mind about that moment is the disbelief that something like that could happen to me, how the police could get it so wrong, and how they show little respect to me in the moment, and how, you know, we are currently dealing with a system here in the city of Chicago and across the country about, you know, police misconduct and the lack of accountability related to it.
Yeah. And how would you say that that experience shapes not just who you are today, but the work you're doing today?
That experience absolutely kind of catapulted me to where I am now. The need to fight back regarding what happened to me, the need to not be silent and let, you know, the city and others cover up what happened to me, and the need to expose that not only that experience was my experience, but many other families in the Black and Brown community share that experience with me.
Mm-hmm. So the book, as I said, it's called Past the Pain, How to Emerge from Trauma with Purpose. And you you purposely published this memoir on the 7th anniversary of what happened to you back in 2019.
Yes.
Tell me what motivated you to tell your story in that way, in the form of a book.
I wanted to, so when my story came out, in the news. Of course, it hit local and national and some international news platforms. But writing this book and telling my story the way I did in this book is I wanted to not only talk about what happened to me, but help other people like myself and other people in the community to understand that you don't have to be silent. You don't have to be ashamed of something that happened to you, that you can move forward. And I wanted to just really share. Everybody saw how exposed I was regarding the incident. And now I want everyone to know and share this healing journey with me.
Mm-hmm. You open up about your healing journey. You're quite vulnerable in the book. Was that difficult?
Absolutely, it was difficult, but it was also a part of the healing process as a way to fight back. Mm. And so sometimes fighting back, even in your hardest moment, is where is what's going to get you to the other side of your healing journey.
Mm-hmm. The title itself, I think, suggests a journey past the pain. Tell me more about what past the pain means to you right now.
Past the pain is acknowledging and living with the experience. One of the most profound things I think I found in this journey is that I use both my faith and my therapy and also my advocacy as a way to fight back. And my therapist would say to me that you have to accept what happened to you in order to move forward. Mm. And my pastor would say you have to forgive what happened to you in order to move forward. And so I lived in the middle of that, trying to find a balance between acceptance that this really bad thing happened.
Yes.
And then forgiveness, and not so much forgiveness as in forgiving the people for what they've done, but a level of forgiveness that releases me from the trauma so that then I can move forward in my healing journey.
Acceptance and forgiveness is not easy to do, especially
absolutely
the forgiveness
not.
Part, given, again, I always sort of hearken back to the fact that this was all captured on video and so many people got to see it. I can only imagine the feeling for you internally. And when a pastor brings up forgiveness, I don't know, I feel like I would be like, what? How?
Yeah, absolutely. So forgiveness is not something that is easily done. It's a part of the journey as well. But if I don't forgive, then that means I'm holding on to that trauma. And as a part of the healing journey, I have to find a way to release it.
Mm. So you're doing this for you.
The forgiveness is for me. And so I want people to know that the forgiveness is for them, not necessarily forgiving the other person for their bad actions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you write about your faith quite a bit in the memoir. You know, how you reached for it in order to heal, like you're describing right now. But you actually talk about questioning your faith on the night that this happened.
Absolutely.
You write, you know, where were you, God? I screamed the words into the silence, my voice shaking with confusion, anger, and devastation. My entire body trembled as I tried to process what had just happened in my two-bedroom apartment in Chicago. What were you thinking about God in that moment?
I was thinking that God wasn't there to protect me. I felt abandoned. I serve a God that is all-knowing, which means that God knew that this was happening before it happened. He knew when they signed the warrant at 10 a.m. that morning that they were going to come into my home that evening. And so in that moment, I felt abandoned. I felt like God did not protect me from this awful thing happening to me.
Mm.
But also my faith tells me that we can question God in the heart spaces, but then there is a moment where we have to kind of like work through that questioning to get to a point of forgiveness for myself, get to a point of accepting that God knows what he's doing, even when we don't.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all a part of the journey.
Yeah. You talk about a few different women in your book. You talk about your grandmother, Lucienda. As well, right? The book is dedicated to her. Is
Lucienda,
that right?
Lucienda, yeah.
Lucienda. And you say after the night of the raid, you were talking to yourself and you were saying, you know, they're not going to get away with this. I'm Lucienda's grandbaby. I have to fight.
Yes.
Take me back to that place.
Yes. So in that moment when I said that, I don't know that I quite understood what that meant, other than the fact that my grandmother was someone who was a fighter.
Mm.
She was a part of the civil rights movement. She fought for rights in her community and voters' rights in the state of Mississippi. So I always seen my grandmother as a fighter. So I knew that I wanted to fight back. I did not know what that meant. I did not understand in that moment the magnitude of a system like the Chicago Police Department in the city of Chicago and what it meant to fight for my own justice with that system.
I wonder if she was with you in that moment, and that's where it sort of subconsciously came from, the thought.
Absolutely. Absolutely. My grandmother is someone that even before this moment has always guided everything that I've done in my life. So absolutely.
How did you decide when you were writing Past the Pain what to include and what things to just keep private?
I don't know that I kept anything private. I put it all on the pages.
Tell me more about that choice.
Because that was a choice that was forced upon me through our legal process. The city of Chicago initially refused to engage with my legal team when we first started that the legal process, and they denied what happened to me. They denied all of the things that we saw happening, and it took almost a year and a half before we could get the body cam footage to release it. And so the city of Chicago forced me to expose the worst moment of my life because they would not come forth or be accountable for what happened.
Yeah.
And so being exposed through the city, being exposed through that video, helped me to get to a point that it's all out there now. I mean, when you think about being completely naked in front of, 12 officers, and then part of that being shown in a news video,
yeah,
it's all out there. And so with writing this book, I wanted to put it all on the pages.
Mm-hmm. You, as we talked about, you include the advice from your therapist. Her name is Alicia Trofmead.
Yes.
And I want to hear more about that decision to throw her words into this memoir as well.
Her words were so instrumental in my healing journey that if I was going to put out a book that talks about my journey, put out a book that I hope will help other people in their journey, I, with being transparent with everything and in my entire process, Alicia was a very important part of the process. I tell people that it's not often that you have a therapist on speed dial, but Alicia was on speed dial for me.
There
were so many moments where it was after hours and so many moments where I didn't have scheduled appointments with her. But because I was experiencing something, she would answer the phone for me.
What does therapy look like for you now, 7 years later?
7 years later, therapy looks like it being intentional. I still have to have those moments. I still meet with Alicia because even when I talk about the book in an experience like today, it requires me to do some upfront work with Alicia to say, hey, I have this interview that I'm doing and I know I'm going to talk about the book and I know it's going to bring up things for me. And she kind of helps me to think about grounding techniques and things that I can do in the moment to keep myself balanced.
I want to pivot now, Anjanette, to talking a bit about the Oversight Board, the Community Commission on Public Safety and Accountability, or CCPSA. It's a 7-person commission. It oversees the Civilian Office of Police Accountability and the Chicago Police Board. For folks who may not know, Anjanette, I mean, why does it matter who sits on this board?
I think it's important. So if we give a little history, this commission or this board came about as a result of the federal consent decree that the city is under.
Right.
And so that's where the commission began. And so it's important to include individuals like myself to be a part of this commission because the community deserves to have a right to say or deserves to have a say and what is happening when it comes to police accountability and police oversight, because the community is the one that has been harmed by some of these bad policing practices.
Yeah, the Oversight Board also it has the power to set policy for the Chicago Police Department, which is huge, right? Reform, we've been trying to get reform for a very long time, well before what happened in your case in 2019.
Correct.
Tell me the first set of changes that you want to push for.
Well, so the commission has already set guidelines. And so I'm going to be going in as a person that I want to learn what's currently in place. And then I want to see how my voice can be used to enhance to enhance those things.
I see. You've been particularly demanding changes to no-knock searches, right?
Yes.
What has the response been from CPD?
So CPD is not actively, connected to my fight for no-knock warrant. I have worked with top CPD officials as it relates to the most recent police policy changes that happened this past last year. And so my work with no-knock warrants and pushing for change is been primarily with local officials on the city level, and then state officials on the state level. Leader Cam Buckner has pushed for a bill that we are actively working in Springfield that will hold police accountable. But also the bill includes some safety measures. So we want to make sure that our police officers are also safe in their work.
Yeah. And so you mentioned Springfield. You went with Cam Buckner earlier this month, right?
Yes.
To advocate for this. And the bill would be called the Anjanette Young Act. So not only is it banning the no-knock warrants and focused on safety, as you mentioned, it's also talking about pointing guns at kids during raids.
Yes. So as a part of my journey and my advocacy, I learned that I was not the only person to have the similar experience as a wrong raid on my home. And many of the families who did have those same experiences here in the city of Chicago, small children were involved. And so as a social worker, I've always been one who wanted to advocate for care of individual families and children. And so it was important to me as we look at policy change and how the police interact with communities, we want to protect our children. No child should have to ever experience an assault rifle being pointed at them or seeing their parents in handcuffs and assault rifles being pointed at them. That is something that traumatizes children at a very early age, and then that carries on with them throughout their entire lives.
Yeah. And, you know, as we mentioned, so many efforts in the past, and I got to admit, so many agencies and acronyms for us to sort of wrap our minds around, right? We're talking right now about the CCPSA.
Yeah.
There's COPA. There's the CPD. There's the police board. You're on the verge of taking on a key role to help shape some much needed policies, Anjanette. It's a huge undertaking. I wonder if you feel pressure to get things right.
Absolutely. I feel pressure because when people see me and they understand my journey and my story, everybody has an agenda of how Anjanette Young should engage and act on this particular commission. And I want people to know that I do hold a level of responsibility and accountability to the community, but not in the sense that I want others to tell me how I should perform in this role. When I interviewed for this role with the current commission and district councils, I share with them that I bring a level of trust and respect from the community that I've earned over the last 7 years. And I want to make sure that I stay authentic to that and not be led or pushed into other people's agenda as I step into this role.
And as you think of that and this entire journey, what do you hope that readers of your memoir, Past the Pain, especially survivors of trauma, what do you hope they take away?
I hope people can see themselves in my story, and I hope people can understand that, you know, even though they experienced something that was traumatic, that there's no shame or guilt that they should own in that, and there is a path forward in healing, and I give very tangible steps in my book on how they can connect and find ways to their own healing journey.
That's Anjanette Young. She's a social worker, a CPD reform advocate, and now an author. Her memoir, Past the Pain, How to Emerge from Trauma with Purpose, is out now. Anjanette, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago, where research meets real-world impact. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration blends classroom learning with extensive field education, guided by faculty known for groundbreaking research. Applications are open at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future. This WBEZ podcast is supported by Wise, the app for international people using money around the globe. With the Wise account, you can send, spend, and receive in up to 40 currencies with only a few simple taps. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. Terms and conditions apply. Be smart. Get Wise.
Let's turn now to the top Chicago area news stories of the day with WBEZ Morning Edition anchor Claire Lane, WBEZ Environment reporter Juan Pablo Ramirez Franco, and Chicago Sun-Times federal courts reporter John Seidel. Uh-oh, a new poll out shows that Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson has some work to do if he's going to run for re-election. Here's Claire with the details.
Essentially, the poll was suggesting that Chicagoans' view of the mayor is dimming a bit. It's a Suffolk University poll of just 500 adults, but still found 44% viewed the mayor unfavorably. 34% say they view him favorably. And as you know, as you've asked him several times, Johnson has still not formally announced whether he's going to be running.
That's right.
At all.
Did we have any details as to why the respondents felt either way, or any particular issues that they want Johnson to address?
So when asked, the most important issue poll respondents say is facing Chicago, nearly one in four cited crime. And we saw this over the weekend, continuing to make headlines with the shooting at Swedish Hospital. Second most important issue they said facing Chicago is the economy, also jobs, followed by housing. That was at 10%. Oddly enough, transportation was only an issue for 2% of people in this poll, which, you know, we've been hearing sort of the opposite of. So something to keep in mind.
We've been hearing the opposite. But yeah, crime has, you know, taken over. A lot of talk of not just, you know, criminal activity in neighborhoods, but also the teen trends or 100%. Teen takeovers. Just, yeah, no surprises for me, at least,
looking at
what folks are most concerned about. You know, something else that's concerning, Juan Pablo, is the weather. You know, it rained a lot yesterday. The rain is fine. I'm good with some rain, but, you know.
I'm just glad you're not asking me about the weather.
That's right. No, I've got Juan Pablo here because when the rain sort of trickles into being bad is when we get into flooding territory, right? It's going to rain again tomorrow. And flooding is on a lot of folks' minds. Our colleague at the Sun-Times, Brett Chase, he just did some recent reporting about how it's getting worse here in the city. What should we know? How bad is it?
I mean, yeah, something to know about rain and climate change particularly is that what we know is going to happen is that as global average temperatures rise in the Midwest and Chicago, what we'll see is more severe rain, but also drought. So expect more rain, as we've sort of seen in the last couple of days.
Yeah, flooding's been a problem, for decades, right? Is the city and state actually taking this seriously enough? Like, what is being done to address the issue?
A good amount. The city of Chicago got a good grant last year to replace some old streets that will help with some of the flooding that we've seen in different parts of the city around the southwest side and the south side. But could they do more? Sure.
Yeah, that's usually the case. Yeah. John, turning to you now, a man accused of shooting two police officers and killing one in front of Chicago's Swedish Hospital over the weekend. Now, federal charges are being brought up here, but not against that suspect, but against the woman who owned the gun. Catch us up on the latest there.
Right. She's actually the woman who purchased the gun in 2024, and those charges were brought in federal court in Indiana. And so Olivia Burgos is accused of being the so-called, it's called a straw purchaser, somebody who went and made the purchase of the gun for somebody else who wasn't lawfully able to make that purchase. And so she went, allegedly lied on federal firearms forms and helped somebody else who she understood, I guess a boyfriend at the time, who she believed to be a convicted felon, obtain that gun. Now where it went from there, we're really not sure. How it wound up in the hands of the man who allegedly shot the officers over the weekend, I think there are still some blanks to be filled out. But we've seen this before in other police shootings. We saw it in the case when Ella French was murdered, I believe, in 2021. We saw federal officials move quickly to bring straw purchasing charges. It's a difficult crime to prosecute because people are often using their clean criminal records to do this.
Yes.
So when they get to sentencing, judges, you know, usually don't throw the book at somebody who's brought there for a first-time offense. But you can see how this can have disastrous consequences.
The wheels are turning in my brain because I'm wondering about how do you trace that back and how you make that connection, you know, as a prosecutor that it was a straw purchaser and this person, you know, and not just Olivia Burgos, but anyone who's doing this wasn't purchasing this for themselves. And then it just happened to get into the wrong hands later.
Right. Yeah.
So how do you connect the two?
Well, the ATF has something set up in Chicago. I believe it's called the Crime Gun Intelligence Center, where they are set up to study these guns, trace them, quickly figure out what the lifespan, what the history of that gun is. And they could go back to the person who filled out the form and purchased it. And Saturday, I believe the day of the shooting, they were there interviewing Olivia Burgos, who admitted that even though she claimed to not be on drugs at the time, she's actually been addicted to fentanyl, I believe it is, since well before the purchase. And this is all as alleged in the criminal complaint, I want to be clear. She allegedly lied about where she was living at the time as well. So
interesting.
So yeah, they were able to actually quickly make that connection with the tools they have here.
This straw purchasing, is that a big deal here in Chicago, a big issue?
It is. And, you know, I think actually when Merrick Garland came to town years ago, there was a big deal that he was really pushing. A lot of times people make these purchases. If they do get caught, they might get kind of a light sentence. But in the case of Ella French, a man named Jamel Danzy, I believe, I think sentencing guidelines called for like 16 months in prison. Mm-hmm. And Judge Gettleman actually gave him 2.5 years. Police officials, police supporters really wanted a much harsher sentence because, again, it might seem like a paperwork crime, lying on a form and getting somebody a gun, but if that gun is then used in a terrible murder or something, you know, the consequences are
serious.
Severe.
Consequences.
Yeah, paperwork and a paper trail, right?
Yes.
I mean, that's the point of all this. Yeah. It leads somewhere or mm-hmm. to someone.
Right.
Now, in other news, Claire, Chicago's own Pope Leo this week shared a video with DePaul students. Now, let's hear a little bit of that, and then I'll have you sort of comment on the back end.
Effective systems of detention can be and have been developed to protect citizens, while at the same time do not completely deprive those who are guilty of the possibility of redemption. This is why Pope Francis and my recent predecessors repeatedly insisted that the common good can be safeguarded and the requirements of justice can be met without recourse to capital punishment. Consequently, the Church teaches that the death penalty is inadmissible because it is an attack on the inviolability and dignity of the person.
So he's marking a specific anniversary here in Illinois, right?
Yeah, so this DePaul gathering also had activist sister Helen, who we heard from yesterday, also Illinois Governor Pat Quinn. Essentially, they got together to condemn capital punishment and to celebrate 15 years since Illinois abolished it. Mm. And as you just heard, Leo, you know, continuing to emphasize the sanctity of life, and this was also part of the World Catholicism Week. So he's been making a series of appearances virtually and otherwise.
The timing here is interesting. You know, his support of banning the death penalty is in line with Illinois' ban, right? Coming at a time, though, when the U.S. president wants to reintroduce firing squads for federal executions. I wonder, is this deepening the divide between the administration and the Catholic Church?
Well, it's a continued disagreement, certainly, between Leo and the current administration. But, Trump's decision Friday that the Justice Department will soon adopt firing squads, as you mentioned, also electrocution and gas as permitted methods of execution, is also a jab at the Biden administration, a moratorium under Biden, after which only three defendants remained on federal death row after Biden converted then 37 of their sentences to life in prison. So I think it's Trump taking a jab yet again at both Leo and also his predecessor, President Biden.
Now, John, you're tracking all the known federal prosecutions in Chicago that were tied to the immigration operation last fall that we know as Operation mm-hmm. Midway Blitz. Prosecutors snagged a guilty plea yesterday. What happened?
They did. A man named Hector Gomez pleaded guilty. The actual charge that he pleaded guilty to was possession of a firearm as a convicted felon. He wasn't lawfully allowed to possess that weapon. But the significance of this case, you may recall, days before the agents left town, there were claims that somebody had opened fire on the agents. And Hector Gomez was somebody who was arrested at the time, not specifically charged with the shooting. He matched the description. He was never actually charged with the shooting, but now as part of the plea deal yesterday, he admitted to firing two rounds in proximity of Customs and Border Protection agents on that day. Mm. So now we have this admission. Now, there's not a lot more detail there, and you'll notice that he didn't say he fired at them. He fired in proximity of them.
Okay.
But we did get that admission and that acknowledgement, and he's set for sentencing in July.
And, I mean, prosecutors have filed charges against a few dozen people in connection with Operation Midway Blitz, right? How successful have they been so far with those?
32 known defendants, not very successful as far as securing convictions. This is the second guilty plea. We've had 20 people have been cleared. The charges have been dropped in one way or another. There are four others who have struck deals which put them on track to see their cases dismissed. So it's not the usual success rate that we see from the U.S. Attorney's Office, but they do now have these two guilty pleas.
Juan Pablo, you've got a new story out. It's about how state agencies in Illinois are facing off over endangered species protections. So let's start with which agencies and then tell us, what's the issue here?
Yeah, so we're talking about the Illinois Department of Transportation, so think roads and bridges, and the Illinois Department of Natural Resources, so wildlife and ecosystem protections. What happened is that we got our hands on documents showing concerns within the DNR about how the Transportation Department skipped over past endangered species protections in 11 different cases last year. Mm. These were mostly aquatic species, and in most cases, DOT would fall back on this sort of controversial rationale that they were in the right because, quote, fish could swim away from construction noise.
Oh, boy. So which listed species are being put at risk?
Yeah, so what we were able to identify were about 20 different species that were potentially overlooked by the DNR.
That's a lot.
So everything from mussels like the ebony shell to small fish like the big eye shiner to large fish like the lake sturgeon and even species like the lamprey.
So what happens now?
Well, now what we know is that both agencies are working together. They're in talks to figure out what happens next with how they're going to handle the Illinois Endangered Species Act.
Mm. Let's jump over to Michigan Avenue, Claire. I hear Water Tower Place is getting a makeover. What's going on?
You heard right. The owner of the Magmal Mall launching a $170 million redevelopment project. This is the latest from Cranes reporting. It's going to be quite an overhaul, doing a lot of rehabbing of some of the stores and atrium. It's also going to remove this two-story escalator you sort of enter with these little floating ponds. That's going to be all gone and create more shop spaces for smaller retailers is what we're hearing.
The project is still in the design and planning phase. So, maybe it's not too late to weigh it. I'm curious what you guys would like to see happen at Water Tower Place.
I think that's a good idea. I mean, big box retail, we're looking at, some communities like Orland Park having this huge behemoth of an Amazon. But the little guys, I think, need spaces too. So I think maybe smaller, more stall-like shops could be a good bet.
I think that's a great idea, supporting, just smaller independent
Mom
businesses.
Mom and pop, baby.
Yes. Yeah, because, Water Tower did start to fall off as far as, foot traffic. People weren't really going there anymore. I remember, just even years ago, my daughters would go there after school and it would be sort of one of the places to hang out. And then that sort of fell off. John's like, no.
John likes to hang out there.
You haven't been shopping at Water Tower lately.
See him at the Cheesecake Factory. Following his stories.
Yeah. Other stories you're following, Claire?
Yeah, the city of Chicago, again, tapping the global consulting firm. This is Ernst & Young for help in addressing its ongoing budget woes, but entering this time into a $6.7 million contract to find some cost-saving measures. But the report that they're referring to identified up to $1.4 billion in potential savings. So maybe there's going to be a benefit there. But this was announced yesterday, and some alders apparently were a little bit peeved to find out about that. So more to come.
I bet they were. John, before we let you go, when you're here, we got to talk about Michael Madigan.
Right.
It's a ritual at this point.
He's always there.
Yeah, our former Illinois House Speaker. So give us the latest.
Michael Madigan got some bad news yesterday.
Ooh.
The Federal Appeals Court, the Seventh Circuit, just summarily dismissed his appeal. They weren't having it. They rejected all his claims and affirmed his conviction. So, again, he's starting to run out of options there. And
this felt like a last ditch effort.
Well, it was fully expected, right? Like, that's what you do. You're convicted, you go to prison, you appeal. is all a matter of course. It was interesting how quickly they turned around this opinion. It's been less than 3 weeks since oral arguments. And now I think we might see some more machinations in the Seventh Circuit, but most notably we're going to be watching to see, he's got some lawyers on his team. Lisa Blatt is a well-known Supreme Court advocate.
Mm-hmm.
So we're expecting he has
might
plans
take this to, the Supreme
to try
Court.
And take, I mean, that's up to the Supreme Court, but he's going to be knocking on their door pretty soon, I suspect. So we'll be watching for that.
Juan Pablo, other stories that you're following?
Yeah, I'll be looking into the local impacts of the Supreme Court hearing a case about the pesticide glyphosate, or Roundup, it's commonly called, and whether its manufacturer, Bayer, is liable for thousands of lawsuits saying that the pesticide causes cancer, and also lead pipes.
Yeah, nice, happy note you're leaving us on there. Thanks, Juan Pablo. WBEZ's Claire Lane and Juan Pablo Ramirez-Franco and John Seidel with the Sun-Times.
This episode of the In the Loop podcast was produced by me, Meha Ahmed, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/in the loop. Thanks for listening.